Good evening and welcome to the Fort Hall Forum. My name is Charles Tsekaris, and I'm a member of the Forum's Board of Directors. Tonight, Dr. Leonard Peikoff joins us for the final program of our fall season to discuss A Picture Is Not an Argument.
Thank you very much, Charles. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You have heard the most important piece of information, which is the website. We live in a world which loves pictures, whether still or moving. Pictures we hear everywhere give us the true, the concrete, the real, as against abstractions, interpretation, theory, all of which is misleading or distracting because it is mere talk. A picture, according to the received wisdom, is worth a thousand words. A picture does not lie, whereas people, especially when emitting clouds of verbiage, notoriously can and do. And I am going to speak throughout tonight only of undoctored, unmorphed, unretouched pictures. In other words, accurate representations of the object involved. Our educators long ago picked up this picture idolatry. Their pride lies in a visual education. Their primary teaching tool, they boast, is no longer reading assignments, but showing movies, whether in a theater or on TV or via computer. Now, pictures may not give us the whole story, the more intelligent of these picturists, as I shall call them, admit, I'll call them other things too. But they go on, pictures almost always make some important contribution to cognition, and they are usually indispensable to reaching the full truth. You see the dichotomy we are offered. On the one side is pictures, which are aligned with truth, education, reality, and on the other side is words, which are aligned with distortion in the form of theory, abstraction, and by implication, philosophy. Picturists, obviously, promote their various causes primarily through the use of pictures. For example, consider the question, is capital punishment valid in regard to a crime such as first-degree murder? Phil Donahue, an inveterate picturist, has long advocated showing a single execution live on TV in order to settle the debate. People, he holds, after they watch the victim's choking, his writhing, his twisting spasms, his bloody convulsions, will grasp directly the evil of capital punishment, and that would stop it once and for all. By contrast, he thinks, professors endlessly debating its pros and cons are irrelevant. Was it right for the U.S. to drop nuclear weapons during World War II? The Smithsonian Institute and many other leftist groups believe that the most telling evidence lies in stills or movies. The ominous mushroom cloud over Hiroshima, the wholesale devastation, the burns and wounds of masses of victims, the genetic freaks of decades later. After all this, the picturists ask, who needs a speech or a book by some foreign policy wonk? Is abortion murder? Does a fetus have rights? Watch the silent scream, the picturists on the religious right advise. See the fetus actually being dismembered and crushed during an abortion. See its little brain being brutally vacuumed out of its head. After that, who needs an abstract discussion of rights? The appeal to pictures as the standard of truth is omnipresent in our society. Should landmines be banned? I quote from Ann Landers, the epitome of a non-extremist. A few months ago, I saw a moving film put together by Physicians Against Landmines, one of these little groups that pop up on an hourly basis. The film showed hundreds of civilians, this is quoting Ms. Landers, the film showed hundreds of civilians who had had limbs blown off by landmines. It convinced me that there should be an international agreement to outlaw these hideous devices, unquote. Are the Los Angeles police brutal thugs? Just watch the whole movie of Rodney King being beaten. Do animals have rights? PETA will provide you with eloquent pictures of baby seals being clubbed to death. Should the Democratic Party advocate more legislation in behalf of the disabled? Pan that camera over to Christopher Reeve in his wheelchair during the 1996 convention. Do we face a threat from global warming? Dial up the Sierra Club website and watch the flames consume the earth. Should American troops enter Somalia? Let the TV network show emaciated children dying of hunger. Should American troops leave Somalia? Let the same networks show the naked corpse of an American soldier being dragged through the streets by the natives. We have now reached the point, thanks to picturism, of foreign policy dictated by TV producers. Now, another angrier term I use for these same people is picture mongers. And my answer to the picture mongers of the world, no matter what their cause or ideology, is simple. I say a plague on all of them. Or to use the more polite title of my talk tonight, a title devised by my wife, Amy, a picture is not an argument. I once asked my radio audience to rate the cognitive contribution of pictures in enabling us to resolve a philosophic or political issue. I had listeners vote on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being pictures are useless and 10 being indispensable. My own vote was minus 10. Because I hold that the picturist method of resolving disputes is epistemologically corrupt, that by its nature it is hostile both to knowledge and to reality, and that it makes reaching a true conclusion on a contested subject not easier, but literally impossible. I don't object to pictures used merely as illustrations, after it has been made clear that the pictures have no evidentiary significance. What I object to is pictures used cognitively in an abstract discussion. Or to put it another way, pictures used to try to solve or even help solve a problem in philosophy or politics. A picture used in such a manner, I hold, represents the antithesis of thought, of logic, of rational argument. To understand why, ask yourself what such a picture does to the viewer's mind. Let us work through a real case this evening. I've picked the issue of abortion. The question is abortion morally right or wrong? Is abortion murder because the embryo or fetus is a person with rights? Or is abortion a non-criminal act because it is merely a woman's decision to dispose of a tissue mass growing in her body? Now, suppose to help you decide this question, I eschew talk, a pejorative term, and instead show you the movie, The Silent Screen. What am I counting on as you sit there for something like an hour watching vivid pictures of cute little creatures with many obvious similarities to newborn babies? The fetus has a head, 5 fingers, 5 toes, 2 ears. As you watch these cute baby-like creatures being attacked, torn into pieces, crushed to pulp. What I am counting on and expecting from you, clearly, is horror, revulsion, a loud no. I am expecting a passionate emotion amounting to the feeling, this is murder, this is evil, this must not be allowed to happen. What am I expecting of your brain, your distinctively human organ of cognition, during this process? Nothing. The movie is designed to bypass the brain. By engaging your focus in an emotionally charged way on the images before your eyes, the movie thereby bypasses all the other knowledge available to you and relevant to the abortion issue, perhaps even essential to its correct resolution. The intense emotion causes you to narrow your focus, to become blind to every other consideration. In epistemological terms, it causes you to drop the context. In other words, the picture seduces you into responding to a concrete example while blithely ignoring all of the surrounding information that would enable you to interpret the picture rationally. The movie makes that information recede, fade into seeming insignificance, and disappear from your mental screen. The movie shows you clearly the similarity, which is real, between the fetus and the newborn baby. But what information, as an example, does the movie not give you? It omits the fact that there is a long, unbroken continuum stretching from the zygote to the embryo, to the fetus, to the neonate, to the child, the teenager, the adult, the shrinking old man twitching on his bed, right on to the corpse, its gradual disintegration if left untended, and then to the final pile of ashes, which blows away. If one stops to think about it, everyone, including the advocates and the enemies of abortion alike, knows perfectly well that this continuum exists, and therefore that there are dozens or hundreds of similarities between any two frames of it, including between the fetus and the baby. No advocate or enemy of abortion ever believed that the fetus looked just like a tiny hippopotamus, or like a Mercedes-Benz, say, until the seventh month, when it suddenly transmuted into a tiny man-like creature. So showing a movie of a fetus highly similar to a baby in the process of being crushed and expecting that to justify a loud no from the audience totally evades the question. It evades all questions, including in that continuum from zygote to ashes, at what point does the object acquire rights, and at what point does it lose them? No visual study of the development, no mere staring or glaring at each stage in succession will give you the answers. At no point does a flag emerge or a flare go off to announce, from here on, it is a person, or from here on, it is not. By engaging your emotions and your focus only on the side of the similarities among the stages, the movie neglects the differences. It is therefore unable even to raise such an issue as, where do you draw the lines in defining a person, and how do you know that's where to draw them? At what points in the continuum does the difference outweigh the similarity, so that the thing you are seeing is not yet or no longer a person with rights? Only a man prepared to deal with broad abstractions and basic principles, a man offering and validating definitions of rights, person, and life can guide us here, which means only a process of philosophic thought, not of watching movies, can give us the answers we need. In actual fact, everyone watching the movie has to decide the issue ultimately, even if implicitly and without admitting it, on the basis of some kind of philosophic principles. How else account for the fact that some of the watchers, believing that the zygote is a person, are horrified to see any medical tampering, as they call it, with it, even at this earlier and, to me, utterly innocuous stage? While at the other extreme, many ancients, such as the Egyptians, believing that the pharaoh's corpse lying in state inside the pyramid is still a person with rights, were equally horrified to see any tampering with the, to me, incontestably dead and gone. The picturist argument, in essence, is, when I see certain images, I feel horror. Therefore, abortion violates rights. This is no argument. It is an utter non sequitur. It is the classic appeal to emotion reviled by every logic text since the time of Aristotle. Now, because abortion is merely an example this evening, I am not going to present my own view of it now, but I'll be happy to in the question period if you ask me. Picturism is a form of epistemological manipulation of the viewer. He is inveigled into turning his mind passively to an isolated segment of a complex issue, which deflects him from the total. Those of you who have read my book on objectivism know that the essence of a proper approach to knowledge is the exact opposite. The proper approach is integration, the study of everything relevant to a question, and then the uniting of all this information into a single, non-contradictory whole. The practitioners of disintegration, by contrast, can permit themselves any nonsense at all. For instance, I hypothesize, you, Peikoff, have been standing there clacking your uppers for about 20 minutes now. That's too long for one person to monopolize the mic when hundreds are sitting here, many eager to speak. What about giving someone else a chance now? Now, the only thing wrong with this argument is that it drops the context. Why I am here, what the terms were of the occasion, how the audience would legitimately react if I give them only a fraction of what was promised. But if my hypothetical heckler disintegrates his knowledge, if he drops all of this and simply zooms his camera in on my lips moving, followed by a shot of a yawner over there and a cougher over here, he may very well convince a viewer of his movie that Peikoff is hogging the mic. Now, I want to say here that pictures can sometimes be a necessary part of a process of cognition. The proper pattern here is the one laid down in our courtrooms. Here, the O.J. case is instructive. Many pictures were introduced at the trial, for example, of the victims, the scene of the crime, and O.J.'s wardrobe, among many others. These pictures gave us abundant information relevant to the concrete case, the individual specific situation at issue in the trial. They enabled the court to make inferences about the strength of the killer, the type of weapon he used, the time of the attack, and so on. They were therefore essential to determining O.J.'s guilt or innocence. In legal terms, the pictures were probative. In other words, they offered relevant evidence or proof. But observe that properly, certain pictures, whose authenticity was not in question, were nevertheless forbidden and could not be shown by the jury, shown to the jury. These pictures, it was ruled, were prejudicial, not probative. They were attempts to inflame the jury, to manipulate its passions without providing any fresh factual information. Now, in dramatic contrast to a murder trial, the issues which people dispute in philosophy and politics always involve broad generalizations or principles. As such, they do not hinge on knowledge of any one concrete. The only way to deal with such issues is by a complex thought process based on decades of life experience and knowledge in a wide variety of areas. To this process, nothing cognitive can be contributed by a picture, whether still or moving. In philosophy and politics, a picture is always prejudicial, never probative. The picture offers perceptual data only, with no indication as to their proper interpretation. What probative information, for example, do you get from the silent scream that is not available to everyone who has lived, scanned a medical or biology text, and thought about his experiences? What cognitive material does the picture give you that is relevant to the abortion issue and new? Nothing. A philosophic question can be considered only by a philosophic mind, which means a mind that accepts a philosophic, not an imagistic or cinematic method of approach. The picturist reliance on an out-of-context emotional response not only destroys cognitive integration, it also negates the very concepts of principle and of objectivity. Take principle, for instance, the law of gravity. A principle is a generalization purporting to integrate countless essentially similar cases into a single unit. This kind of conclusion can be reached only by an exacting, inductive methodology. No such conclusion follows from any picture or movie, or from any single experience. What principle follows from an apple dropping? Nothing. And that is not how Newton made his discovery. What principle follows from X that fetus, say, suffers a lot? Does it follow that X has rights? Obviously not. The opponents of abortion usually claim their devotion to religious principles, but the picturists among them function by jettisoning the method of principles as such, whether religious or otherwise, in favor of concrete, bound, out-of-context feelings. As to objectivity, the picturist rejection of it follows not only from Ayn Rand's definition, but even from the simplest common sense idea of objectivity, namely weighing the available evidence pro and con and then deciding dispassionately. This is exactly what the picturist method, with its appeal on subjective feeling, forbids. Now, since feeling as such is subjective, those who use it as their standard of knowledge can claim at whim to prove or disprove anything. Imagine a picturist misanthrope, for example, watching the silent scream and feeling glee at what he imagines is the torture and murder of a human being. He comes out of the theater saying, "Great, let's have more abortions." Now, this conclusion has as much or as little validity as that of the anti-abortionists watching the same movie, because both employ the identical method, or more accurately, non-method. Picturists of every stripe are guilty not only of bad reasoning, but of many big lies, capital B and L. They tell us that pictures are vehicles of information, when in fact they use pictures to obliterate information. They tell us that pictures will clarify and focus our mental process, when in fact their pictures act to misdirect our focus. They tell us that pictures are our means of contacting reality, when their whole technique consists in habituating people to evade reality. The picturists tell us that the picture they beam at us is education, when in fact it is nothing but propaganda and brainwashing. Now, I hope you don't feel my introduction to the topic has been too wishy-washy so far. At this point, someone may want to tell me that my argument does not refute the cognitive claim of pictures, as I have been saying, but merely of isolated, out-of-context pictures. Suppose I imagine at least one of you objecting. Suppose that I show a movie of the entire case in regard to some topic, including visuals of every relevant aspect. Wouldn't the sum of those pictures amount to the full truth and thus constitute an objective proof? Now, this is a perfect objection because it demonstrates eloquently that the objector has missed a profound philosophical point. I want to start my answer by telling you about an experience of mine, the experience that first led to my interest in tonight's topic. A few years ago in California, I agreed to appear in a formal debate on abortion before a large audience of college students. I agreed because I was assured by the host, who was serious and sincere, that civility would rule the occasion. I announced the event on my radio show, hoping to attract listeners to it. About a week before the debate, I discovered that my opponent intended to offer, quote, visual material, unquote, as part of his presentation. When I objected vehemently, the host told me he was at a total loss. As to why I objected, that I could present whatever visual material I wanted as part of my presentation, and that he would remove all limitations on time from me if I was concerned. I refused flat out. We had the obvious argument, at the end of which I withdrew and then denounced the event on the radio. Now, since I have the truth on my side in this issue, why did I not take the host up on his offer? The answer has nothing to do with time or money. Project that I have the time, the money, the skill, the experts, everything necessary to make a great 5, or you want to expand it, 10-hour movie, which would include visualizations of everything I could think of relevant to abortion. If an impartial audience were then forced to judge the issue by watching my movie versus the silent screen, that audience, I maintain, would necessarily and validly vote for the anti-abortion movie. I would lose by a landslide, even though my position was the truth. I would lose because my position was the truth. The true position on any philosophic issue I hold would always lose in a contest of movies, even if the movie depicting the true side was a cinematic masterpiece. I see some people surprised at that. To show you why, Let me suggest a rough idea of some of the things my abortion movie would need to cover in visual terms. Well, the first thing I think of is that I would want to show back alley abortions resulting from a law banning abortion, with women hemorrhaging and dying after the ministrations of quacks. That would be an eloquent picture of a real and relevant fact. I would also show women in mental hospitals who broke down in the face of the responsibility of a lifelong job of unchosen motherhood. I would show mothers sobbing over lost careers, or over the father who fled, or over the wrenching poverty caused by babies they couldn't afford to support. I would show unwanted babies being neglected, maltreated, even in Chicago, thrown out of 12-story windows. All of this, however, is merely the movie's beginning, because so far I have given only pictures with a blatant emotional appeal. To a rational person, I have offered no means to decide whether the fetus is a person or not. I have shown misery stemming from the inability to abort legally. But that misery taken by itself is perfectly compatible in logic with the fetus still having rights. So now I need to add the visuals necessary to decide on the issue of rights. Well, what are these visuals like? Presumably, though I'm not able in my movie to make speeches, I can depict in visual terms the difference between the way animals resolve disputes and the way humans do. And that would at least get me started, I think, in this sequence on rights. So I show lions fighting each other tooth and claw, and then men shooting at bears about to attack them, and then some men in rags screaming at and killing each other, and then some well-dressed men in obvious disagreement about something who are talking it over quietly instead of fighting. But then my audience may wonder, well, what does it all mean? Could fighting with others perhaps be more natural and practical than yammering forever when you disagree? Maybe the lions have something. So I hasten to add to my movie a sequence on the results of these different forms of human interaction. After the ragged men fighting say, I show caves. And after the men talking, I show skyscrapers. Would my audience get the point yet? Well, I'm trying to hint that man survives by reason, and so he should respect the autonomy of others and try to persuade them in case of disagreement, not force his desire on them as if they were animals. But this point somehow is not quite clear yet. I guess I'll have to visualize the issue of reason for them first. So to get that idea across, I show pictures of scientists looking through a telescope as against priests praying on their knees. Plus, say, to make everything fully clear, pictures of mathematicians with blackboards full of equations as against Shirley MacLaine placing a bet at Santa Anita after knocking on wood. But still it dawns on me, even if people somehow get my drift, I haven't explained yet that reason must be an absolute, which is why rights are absolutes, i.e. inalienable. So why is reason an absolute? Back to the drawing board. More pictures, as I try to sketch in the idea that human life requires a definite course of behavior, because men always act in the face of an alternative, to be or not to be. Now, how will I get across the idea that human life is conditional and a rational course of action, therefore, necessary? I know. a whole new series of pictures to stress that man is not immortal. Pictures of deaths and even of suicides would be a good start. And I might also benefit from pictures of drawn-out mass suicide caused by mass unreason, as in a whole generation's drug addiction, or as in communist dictatorships. But wait, I still haven't answered another question. Even if reason is an absolute, and man does have inalienable rights, is the fetus an entity that can come under the concept of rights? Or is it merely an attribute of the mother, which as such has no rights? So now I need to forget dictatorship and even reason, let alone abortion, and start showing pictures of metaphysical categories, with emphasis on pictures of entities like tables, chairs, and rocks, to convey that crucial concept, as against pictures of attributes like shape, color, and size. And by the way, where am I going to put a picture of a toenail or a tumor? With the entities or with the attributes? But wait, I just remembered. Everybody talks about the unfairness of abortion. Unfairness to the fetus, or the unfairness of non-abortion to the unwilling mother. More pictures, this time to convey the idea of fairness or justice and how it applies to this situation. Now you can take it from here. If I had 2 more hours, I'd have 2 more hours of brief descriptions of pictures, all irrelevant. How the greatest director in the world would organize this movie is beyond me. All I can project is some kind of messy juxtaposition of men talking to each other, women with coat hangers coming out of their womb, animals snarling and clawing, tables and chairs followed by red and green patches, then maybe suicides, toenails, red china, and blackboards full of equations. But suppose any order you want, and suppose the filmmakers are even allowed words to identify the frames. I can have captions. For instance, saying, "This man is shooting a bear," "This is an unwanted baby being thrown out the window," etc. Is it not obvious that in a contest for an audience's response between my movie and the silent scream, the latter wins and wins rightfully, while I lose dismally? I lose even though my movie has every relevant aspect of the issue in it somehow, whereas theirs is merely a narrow, biased concrete. I lose because of one basic reason. My movie is missing something. Something crucial. Some one thing, and it's not more pictures. I'm going to give you 10 seconds to figure out what it is. And here's my only hint. The answer leads to the most profound issue of epistemology. Okay, see if you can figure it out in 10 seconds. The one thing my movie is missing. The picturist movie lacks a punch because it focuses on a single issue. A baby-like creature being torn apart. As such, the film as a whole is easily grasped and retained by the audience. My movie, however, is all over the map by the very nature of the assignment. I have to raise complex subjects and change them continually, and therefore it is impossible for people to follow. And even if by some miracle I could give continuity to this 5-hour montage of images, it would be impossible for anyone, myself included, to retain it as a whole. My viewers would have seen so many pictures on so many subjects for so many hours that they could not keep the sum of it all in their minds. In effect, each sequence of my movie would go in one eye and out the other. The result would be disorientation of the viewer, squirming boredom, and then sooner or later, his faculty of concentration giving up and tuning my movie out. Truth, and especially philosophic truth, as I've already said, requires the integration of a complex variety of data. By the use of our senses alone, however, for example, by seeing a movie, we cannot retain that much data, not as a whole. Now you say to me, what about a silent movie? A silent movie can tell a unified, retainable story, but it is a story about a concrete person or situation, not about abortion in general and whether it's right or wrong. A talking movie, by contrast, especially one with speeches, can make a unified philosophical case for some position. But that is because of the talking, not because of the pictures. The point is that the kind of pictures relevant to a philosophic issue, even if they could all be presented in a single movie, could not be integrated or retained by anyone because such a quantity of data violates a key requirement of man's mind. And I mean the requirement that Ayn Rand called the crow epistemology. For those of you who are unfamiliar with this, I'll just tell you briefly that a study of crows many years ago showed that they can hold a maximum of 3 units in their consciousness at any one time. For instance, if 3 men enter an area, the crows would hide from them in this experiment. And if 2 men leave, the crows stay hidden, realizing that there's still 1 left. But if the crows see 5 men enter and 4 leave, they come out, because they can't hold and distinguish 5 units in their consciousness at the same time. Ayn Rand's point is that our mind is the same in this regard as that of the crow. The same. Perhaps we can hold 6 or 8 objects, but no more. Not with each one distinct in our consciousness at the same time. At a certain point, if we keep adding elements, we start to lose some of the earlier ones. The data start to slip away from us, or else we lose them all at once, tuning out helplessly through mental overload. Now, this, according to Ayn Rand, is precisely why man needs concepts. A concept is a means of integration. What a concept does is to condense an unlimited amount of data into a word, which we thereafter retain and use as a single unit, even though that word includes and carries with it our knowledge of countless instances. The obvious example is the concept man, which enables us to hold in mind and think about an unlimited number of concrete cases. All man ever, past, present, and future. The concept enables us to come to conclusions about that unlimited number of instances. For instance, we can say and understand easily that all men are mortal. Yet if we confined ourselves to our senses, we could never even hope to see or even to imagine all men, let alone ascribe various attributes to such an immensity. So Ayn Rand sums up, concepts economize the number of units required for us to hold a given content in mind. The same account applies, in essence, to philosophic concepts. A philosophic concept such as rights integrates countless observations, generalizations, definitions, and inferences into a single word. If you have formed the concept correctly, then the simple word rights condenses all of that information into a single unit and keeps it active in your mind. And this, in turn, enables you easily to answer most questions about who or what has rights and who or what doesn't have them. Philosophic issues are necessarily conceptual issues. They cannot be raised or answered on the perceptual level. In the nature of the case, we cannot hold information dealing with the universe as a whole, or knowledge as a whole, or man as such, by purely sensory means. We can hold that scale of information only in the form of broad conceptual statements and arguments. So Hegel is right in saying that the true is the whole. And no mind can grasp the whole in regard to a philosophic issue by means of pictures. That is the deepest reason why a movie representing the true position would always lose in any public contest with a false propagandistic movie. Pictures as used today are an assault on the very essence of the human mind. The picturists raise the kind of questions possible only to a rational, conceptual being, and then purport to answer these questions by animal means, by simple sense perception. This is another blatant contradiction on their part. Now, what I'm calling picturism tonight is merely an example of a much broader disease. It's an example of what Ayn Rand called the perceptual level mentality or the anti-conceptual mentality. This happens to be the most popular form of anti-reason in the world today. You can find it almost anywhere you look. For further details, I refer you to Ayn Rand's article, The Missing Link, available in her book, Philosophy, Who Needs It? Now, I want to repeat that I have nothing against pictures used properly, such as probative photographs in court, or maps when you're driving, or news events photographed in the press or on TV. Pictures are used properly to convey information about a concrete. And pictures are also proper as illustrations of a principle that has been proved true independently by conceptual means. For example, pictures of misery in China contrasted with scenes of happiness in America are legitimate. But the pictures by themselves prove nothing, nothing about the merits of either political system. They say nothing about the differences between the systems or about the causes of the emotions being photographed. Such pictures may legitimately accompany an argument, but they may never substitute for one. For the same reason, pictures may legitimately be used to generate emotions in behalf of a given cause, but only if and when the validity of the cause is first established coldly and logically by conceptual means. In regard to philosophic or political problems, of course, there is no question of using pictures in these ways, that in other words, to inform, to illustrate, or to excite. As thinkers, we seek the dry, objective, abstract truth on an issue, of which the picturist cascade of images is the enemy. Now, I want to add here that propaganda using pictures is much more dangerous and evil than written propaganda ever could be. The written variety, for example, the kind of tracts turned out by the Nazis or Scientologists or Republicans, makes no difference, is ignored by most people as being too boring and or too demanding to read. Those with the stomach to pick such stuff up often have little difficulty in detecting the falsehoods being peddled. The picturist propaganda, by contrast, appeals to the laziest, most passive mass audience it can find, and purports to give such people the truth on complicated issues with no further effort required of them than for a while to separate their eyelids. To the extent that such audiences think about epistemology at all, even if only implicitly, They undoubtedly feel that the pictures they watch are reliable as victims of truth, because they would say, if prompted, seeing is believing. And so it is, except that the aphorism means that the senses are valid, not that they are a substitute for thought. In some part, therefore, such audiences, even though passive, may be regarded as innocent victims of the picturists. The picturists count on men's automatic acceptance of the senses in order ultimately to detach their victims from the data given by the senses. They use the fact that the senses are men's primary means of grasping reality in order to teach men unknowingly to evade the facts of reality. They use people's valid confidence in the perceptual level of consciousness, which level should be the beginning from which men proceed to the development of rationality. They use it to freeze mankind permanently on the cognitive level of animals. I defy anyone to invent a more viciously successful trick, successful in terms of the millions of people hoodwinked forever into the sincere conviction that their pet falsehood is the absolute truth, and that they have seen the truth with their own eyes. Now, sometimes the picturist method is used to elicit from people a positive emotional response. The outstanding example of this occurs in TV advertising, such as spots showing a new automobile being driven by babes in bathing suits, eyed hotly by lusty young hunks. The message being, this car is exciting, sexy, buy it. By far the dominant practice among philosophic or political picture mongers, however, virtually the law governing them, is the appeal not to the positive, but to the negative. The picturists do not try to evoke admiration, uplift, or enthusiastic affirmation, but rather horror, fear, and above all, compassion. Compassion for the misery they see and show us everywhere. Thus, all the images of screaming fetuses, starving children, bloody clubbed seals, landmine victims blown apart, and mushroom clouds raining catastrophe. There's a reason why the picturists are so drawn to the negative. The reason is that the epistemology of picture mongering as an expression of the perceptual level mentality leads inexorably to its own kind of ethics. The first consequence of being a perceptual level mentality is that one loses or never acquires confidence in reason. The skepticism that we see everywhere today, there is no certainty. What's true for you isn't true for me. There are no absolutes. Who can know reality as it is in itself, etc.? All of that is an inevitable consequence of people rejecting the conceptual level of consciousness. Since concepts are man's distinctive means of knowledge, their rejection or atrophy has to lead to a sense of helplessness, ignorance, and worse than ignorance, the sense that one can never know or understand the truth, not on any question that really counts. And the corollary in action of this sense of futility is, I can never achieve my goals and values, not any of them that really matter. Today's legion of mindless, picture-craving, would-be human animals are doomed to fail in thought and in action, and they know it. They know it and they feel it. Hence the emotional leitmotif of our culture. Now, a cultural leitmotif is not an accident. It's not a primary. It flows from a culture's basic philosophy. 150 years ago, when men were still being shaped by the Enlightenment era's stress on reason, the dominant emotional leitmotif was called optimism. People of that period expected never-ending progress and believed, actually as a self-evidencing, that the perfection of man and his institutions was coming ever closer. This was a version with some errors of what Ayn Rand calls the benevolent universe outlook. In other words, the view that human values and happiness can be achieved on Earth. Today, by contrast, after the prolonged Kantian assault on man's mind, the emotional leitmotif is the opposite. Our culture exudes, expects, and embraces misery, loss, doom. It holds what Ayn Rand calls the malevolent universe viewpoint, symbolized eloquently by Kierkegaard and Sartre and all the other angst-ridden nausea worshippers who hold that man's metaphysical destiny is failure. Today, most people regard defeat and suffering as real, and success or happiness, if they ever encounter it, as a fleeting accident. Such people feel sincerely that life by its nature is like a giant hospital or war zone in which we are caught, and in which no one, therefore, is responsible for his plight. The only moral duty, they conclude, is to ease someone's pain, because nothing more is possible on this earth. Thus, today's spectacle of a competition in suffering, with ever new groups rushing to flaunt the fact that they are victims in need of solace, and of course, cash. They were abused, they are disabled, they suffer from road rage, they are homeless, they are hungry, they have the disease of the month, or they already feel painful contrition for their many lies, so please don't make it worse by impeaching them. It is obvious to what kind of ethics and politics this cultural leitmotif leads. It is obvious how it plays into the hands of altruism and welfare statism, and how it makes any defender of egoism and capitalism seem cold, unfeeling, and even reprehensible. Today's worship of pain is not an objective conclusion about man, life, or government. Our skeptical professors, who feel the same kinship to pain that their victims do, would be the first to insist that no conclusions, including their own, are objective. What then is the status of their metaphysical viewpoint? My answer is that it has no cognitive status. It's merely the howl of despair that regularly emanates down the centuries from men who try to survive without the human tool of survival. We are caught in a vicious circle. Kant's rejection of reason led to an anti-conceptual society and thus to the culture of helplessness and despair, which is verbalized as altruism and statism. But this senseless culture, in turn, seems to confirm men's rejection of reason and makes people even more deeply anti-conceptual and thus even more ripe for the picture mongers. In essence, the perceptual level mentality leads to the malevolent universe, which reinforces the perceptual level mentality. The picturists that I have been condemning this evening are simply the propagandists who jump in at an advanced stage of this vicious circle and try to cash in on our cultural decadence for their own special ends, whether personal and or ideological. And it's important to note that the emotions the picturists work so hard to evoke are not causeless, and they do not follow directly from the pictures. Percepts or pictures by themselves, unevaluated by a man's mind, evoke no emotional response. The mere photograph of a bare arm extended with a needle about to be injected into it generates no response in you, not if you have no evaluation at all of the situation. If you then discover that it's life-saving drugs being fed to a hero, you have one type of response. If it's cocaine being injected into a child by a pusher, you have an opposite response. Those who show us the pictures of misery and expect thereby to invoke a passion for self-sacrifice and big government are counting on the premises of altruism and statism, which they themselves accept as unquestionable axioms. People in America are stuffed full of this corrupt philosophy, of whose real meaning most are largely ignorant, and they exhibit and respond to the conventional picture propaganda automatically, as though the pictures themselves were the direct cause of their emotional reaction. But an objectivist looking at the bloated belly of a Somalian child, or at a city ruined by an atomic bomb, or at the silent scream, would not respond with blind, unthinking compassion. He would ask some hard questions, such as, what am I seeing? Why did this happen? Who is responsible? What does justice dictate here? What does logic have to say? A person's philosophy determines his emotional response. The picture mongers have simply found a new way of cashing in on an old and false philosophy without even needing to acknowledge that it exists. A practical leech, if such exists, would suck heartily on the body of his host while hoping the man continues to remain alive and healthy so that the blood keeps on flowing. The picturists, however, are impractical leeches. They suck on pictures while working to destroy everything that makes their pictures possible. The perceptual level is given to us by nature, but photographs, whether still or moving, are an achievement of man's mind. Their existence required a long history of rational thought, including Aristotelian philosophy, modern science, the invention of technology, and then almost two centuries of an industrial civilization based on individual liberty, as bequeathed to us by the founding fathers. All of that was necessary for a few geniuses to invent and produce today's photographs. Can anyone believe that simple animal-like sense perception created movies, television, computers, CD-ROMs, or even old black-and-white stills? What a travesty it is for corrupt propagandists to use all these achievements in order to destroy their deepest source, in order deliberately to warp the minds of men, wreck their ability to focus on reality, and thus in the end wipe out all achievement, including photography itself. But this travesty does not have to continue. Not if we go out and reclaim human achievement, including photography, from the bloodsuckers. All we have to do is establish, or if you count ancient Greece, the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, all we have to do is reestablish reason as our guide to knowledge. And after that comes everything good, including virtue, values, freedom, success, and the conviction of a benevolent universe. So, as in every talk I give, I come back to my lifetime theme song, my website, PWNI Philosophy, who needs it? I need it. You need it. The whole world needs it desperately. After Ayn Rand, we have the philosophic knowledge necessary to fight all the cultural battles and ultimately to win the war. I've been fighting these battles for 47 and a half years now, ever since I met Ayn Rand in the spring of 1951. And I say that even now, it is not too late. I myself am still going strong, not by writing or lecturing now, as most of you probably know, but by working in radio. I know it's late, but permit me an aside before I end to explain why I chose radio, because it's highly germane to my thesis tonight. I would never agree to host a TV show, for instance, not even if someone asked me to, which no one has. The reason is that talk radio is necessarily a conceptual medium. Its essence is words. TV, by contrast, is primarily a visual medium. That is why talk on TV, I'm leaving aside news-oriented shows, is so largely light entertainment, as in the Leno show, or emotional shock, as in the Springer-type shows. The better type of intellectual talk show hosts, like Dennis Prager or Rush Limbaugh, have tried TV but couldn't succeed in the medium. And I believe the reason is that serious discussion on TV leads ultimately to one thing. It leads to the producer of the show blanching at his comparatively low ratings and crying to the host, "Don't be a talking head. This is not a college class. Do something to get an audience. Show some pictures." And my answer to that would be, not me. Now, whether radio is of interest to you or not, I invite you to join me in the battle for the world if you choose to do so, and to fight in any form you choose. But I would only like to suggest one limitation. What we need on our side now is something special. Not good eyes, but a good brain. Not visual aids, but intellectual aid. Not any more pictures, but a lot more words. The kind of words that make up letters to the editor, and lectures, and articles, and books written by thinkers. What we need is men of the mind, not of the eyeballs. Only you, or those among you, who use and cherish language can enable the rest of mankind to discover what the kaleidoscope of pictures that are showered on it daily actually mean. Only your voices can thereby counteract the glittering trash of the picture mongers and help to give us a new start once again, and ultimately a whole new renaissance, an era, I hope an eon, animated as before by the knowledge that rational argument, in other words, reason, is man's unique power of sight and thus the root of all his glory. In that kind of society, when it comes, you will not have to suffer institutionalized torture any longer or wait impatiently for the evil to lose its grip or dream wistfully of the ideal. You will already have won the war and caught up at last with man's breathtakingly pure and joyous future. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doctor.
I think I'll move over here.
Good.
If that's okay.
Right here. Thank you very much for your most provocative remarks. Now's the time for your questions, ladies and gentlemen. If you have a question, please step up to the mics. We have two, one here, one there. I'm going to alternate. And the time is about 10 after 8, and I'm committed to having about 25 to 30 minutes of question and answers. And my only request is that you ask one question each so that many people will be able to ask their questions. Start right here.
Thank you, Dr. Peacock. As a person who's given up on television news, I can certainly understand about the comment of the philosophical content of...
I can't see which side the question's... Oh, it's right there. Okay.
Could you get just a little closer?
A little closer, okay. I can understand about your comment about the philosophical content of pictures being negative 10, but what about the philosophical content or role of art, like painting or sculpture, which is visual? What does that have a philosophical content of negative 10?
Yes, certainly. I anticipated that as one of the questions. I had that section actually written, but it's impossible to cover everything, and I went over long as it was. Art, certainly visual art, is a great value and does certainly, in the case of the visual arts, is entirely pictorial. But my thesis remains unchanged. I don't deny the value or the philosophic significance of painting. It is not an argument. You cannot prove a philosophy by means of visual art. You can embody it. You can take the sense of life that a given philosophy would lead to and make it so real that the viewer of the painting enters that world and feels that feeling and looks at the world the way you see it. But that can be done with true philosophies and with bad philosophies, and in any art, visual or not. It's a separate question, which philosophy is true and how do you prove it? So the only seeming contradiction to what I'm saying is if you had a philosophic novel, well, that of course is not pictures, with a long philosophic speech in it, which gives the proof. But if you took the speeches out, then without them, you simply have an interesting novel, provocative novel, but you don't yet have an argument, and therefore you don't have a proof. So I stand by the idea that art is a recreation of reality from a point of view. The proof of the validity of that point of view is something the art can't provide.
Thank you. Thank you. Next.
Given what you've said about the use of pictures on TV, what do you think the impact on TV has been on our culture?
I think the impact of TV on our culture has been highly negative. I don't think that's in the nature of the medium. I think the medium properly used could have been used within a conceptual culture. There are many good things in TV. A lot of good immediate news stories, a lot of dramatic art. In the old days, I was a tremendous fan of, like, Rod Serling, The Twilight Zone. Nothing could have kept me from watching those movies when they came on. They're really good movies. Ayn Rand used to watch a 50s sitcom called Meet Millie, which we thought was hysterical at the time. It was very witty, very intelligent. So I'm not putting down the medium as such, but what is very dangerous is the fact that the kids today are steeped in an MTV kind of barrage of images, which is not only on MTV, fast, what we used to call McLuhan-esque jump cuts, utterly senseless stories, heavy on, quote, action, with almost no dialogue, no motivation, no structure, no meaning, and the whole idea of them and the computer games, which are go along with it, that same type of approach, where all they do is sit for hours steeped in the need to have instantaneous response to pictures without any idea of meaning or philosophy, is extremely harmful training, because it's teaching these kids, it's instilling in them as a habitual method of functioning to drop thinking, to drop ideas, to drop meaning, not to ask why, and just to respond instantaneously like animals on the perceptual level. And I think that has been one of the great contributors to violence in this country. My wife, Amy, made a really fascinating point about this, which was in an earlier draft of the speech that I had to cut for time, because we were talking about the fact that people on the perceptual level don't respect reason and therefore resort to violence. And the more perceptual level a culture gets, the more violence there is, and how television contributes to this. And then she said to me, but then the real point is that TV contributes to violence, not by showing violence, but by the fact that whatever its content is, it's non-conceptual. So that they showed nuns and Mother Teresa tripping along in an MTV fashion, handing out gifts to the lepers, you know, which would be their idea of 24-hour-a-day pure culture and high moral TV, it would cause exactly the same massacres as the present things that are shown. It's not the violence, it's the jump cuts, then the anti-conceptual essence of TV. That was my wife's point. I was so impressed with that, I put a whole excursion into the talk and then cut it out. In fact, I have it here, but now I've given you the essence of it. But I thought that was a really brilliant point to answer the question.
Yes, it is true that TV is causing a lot of violence, but it's not the content. It's the style, which the computer games are simply enhancing. Now, I have to quickly add, I'm addicted to certain computer games, but I do it like with alcohol. You know, I have a drink, I don't become an alcoholic, and I play the games for a couple of minutes, and then I go back to work. Oh, well, she doesn't regard solitaire as a computer game, but I got to the stage where I could turn it on and play solitaire, and I'm very proud of that.
Thank you. Okay. Next one?
Yes. Excuse me, Dr. Peikoff. I wanted to have you compare the concept of pictures with the concept of polls, P-O-L-L-S, polls.
P-O-L-O,
Gallup. Yeah, polls. Throughout the entire year, the Clinton-Lewinsky thing, we constantly hear polls and that the public is in favor of what the president's doing. So since you're part of the media, maybe you can explain what is it that he's doing that the public is in favor of, because all the polls, all they ever say is that the public is in favor of what the president's doing, and it seems like it's ineffective like picture would be.
Well, first of all, I've been called many things. That's the first time I was ever called part of the media. I don't know whether to say thank you or God help me. Do you want me to tell you what I think the public is thinking or what I think of polls? Because it's easy to tell you what I think of polls. Polls don't prove anything except that people think certain things. They're not relevant to truth. They're not relevant to whether the president should be impeached. They're not relevant to anything. And they're very easily swayed by the form of the question. They've shown time and again that you can take the same essential question and by wording it a little differently or by putting it in conjunction with another question, you can come up with very different numbers. So polls are generally unreliable and certainly no standard of truth, but that's not the same issue as pictures. That has nothing to do with pictures. That's another false way of trying to reach the truth, in this case by simply a consensus of opinion. Now, if you want me to get off into Clinton and impeachment, is that what you really want?
What is it exactly, from your interpretation, is that the public is in favor of? What is it that he's doing that they're in favor of?
Well, that's very far from the topic tonight. I'll simply say this. I agree with the public to this extent. I do not think that Clinton should be impeached for the Lewinsky affair. I think there's many, many, many grounds on which he should be impeached, treason being the foremost, his foreign policy. His foreign policy, if he can get away with that, then there can be no discussion about, you know, what he does in the Oval Office, because he's doing it to the country as a whole on a daily basis. So I consider it a farce that the Republicans, you know, got their courage together and decided they're going to pursue illicit sex in the Oval Office in the face of what he has, you know, the basket of goodies that he has to offer them if they wanted to be in opposition. And I think the public, you know, nobody can know the public, but as far as I can tell, they think a huge fuss is being made on purely partisan grounds. And I think they're right, because the Republicans are not fighting for any principle, as their whole behavior in Congress demonstrates. So the only conclusion an honest person can come to is they're moved by nothing but partisanship. And if that's the case, half the people in the country cheat on their husbands. Why shouldn't Clinton too? So I'm not one of those people who say the public's lost all moral standards as proved by their attitude toward Clinton. I don't think that's true. I don't think the public has a very high moral standard, but I think you can find evidence of his low moral standard many other places. I wouldn't start on this issue. There's other things to say, too, about Clinton and picturism, though, that you remind me of, but maybe I should let somebody else
ask.
Hi. There's a quote by Ayn Rand that anyone who fights for the future lives in it today. I've never quite understood it. You mentioned at the end of the talk about wistful dreaming of the future, and I sometimes engage with some of that, and that doesn't sound like that's following the quote, but I'm not sure exactly how it works.
Well, I think you have to take that statement of Ayn Rand metaphorically, because you obviously don't literally live in the future today. I think what she means by that is, especially to her as an artist, who creates a world that is so real that when she's writing, she lives in that world. In that sense, that world that she created is realer to her than when she came out and looks at the shambles around her. And in another sense, you live in it today in the sense that you live by the principles that you project will one day govern the world. But I don't take from that, as you seem to think I should, the solace of, well, it's not so bad that things are so bad because I really am there now. I'm not yet. Okay. That's the best I can do by way of explanation.
Good. Sir?
Dr. Peikoff, thanks from the bottom of my heart for another magnificent lecture. Thank and my question pertains to your concluding remarks regarding the conceptual nature of radio. I wonder whether this means that your callers as a whole are much more conceptually oriented and much more intelligent than the American population at large.
Well, I would say one thing. I don't know my callers specifically, but radio talk show listeners are the older segment of the country. They are dominantly male, and they are, I think, indisputably more intelligent than the average television viewer. It's hard for me to, you know, the demographics vary from station to station, but I do think the best, I'm trying to think of what I could offer you as evidence. The best thing I can, I have an email feature because of the website, and I get email from all over the place on my show, because people hear it on the internet. The station doesn't have to actually broadcast it to their hometown. They can hear it on the internet, and I am truly impressed at the level of the comment and questions and objections that I get on the email, from the email source. Now that, I guess, is people who are motivated enough to actually type out a comment, but it is really impressive. If I took from the years that I was teaching, my average email is on the level of intelligence of my brightest students when I taught in New York City. And that was in what decade? I can't even remember the, when did I teach it? In the 60s. So for what it's worth to you, I have a very great respect for my listeners, for the level of intelligence that they have. Yes, I do.
Thank you very much.
Yes?
To some level, I agree with you that pictures perhaps overused in our society. However, in the beginning of your talk, you made a comment that pictures do not go to our mind. Where do they go? To our feet, nose, stomach, heart?
They go to our sense perception. I make a distinction between sense perception and the intellect, the conceptual faculty, the rational faculty.
But it's all integrated in your mind.
If it is, that's great. But what I'm saying is that picturism acts to disintegrate, not integrate. If you can take a picture and look at it, ask and answer rational questions, interpret it and file it accordingly, more power to you. But that is not what I was talking about this evening. I was talking about people who simply expect showing you a picture to convince you of an answer. And that is always wrong unless it's a concrete, such as OJ. And the picture of shoes proves that he wore that type. That's it. I've given you my answer. Next.
Yes?
Thank you. My question actually relates specifically to Atlas Shrugged, but since you spoke of images tonight, I thought it was relevant. I read that fairly recently, and I noticed that Ayn Rand spent quite a bit of time describing her character's physical appearance.
Yes.
And specifically, Reardon was very attractive and tan, and certainly someone who would be on the front of a magazine, someone you might admire physically, and Dagny Taggart was beautiful, whereas...
What is your point?
I'm sorry. Whereas Reardon's wife, for example, was less than attractive, and...
Oh, no, Lillian was very beautiful.
Lillian
just had disappointing eyes.
Disappointing eyes, whereas Dagny Taggart did not have anything.
So what is your point?
My question is, I'm trying to understand the relationship between physical attractiveness and intellectual
that
superiority.
That is a very different subject than what we're talking about tonight. But I'll answer very briefly. A person's physical attractiveness is partly anatomical and partly psychological. You can have the perfect anatomy and without any meaning, a completely dead face, or filled with venom and anger and despair, etc., and be an unattractive person. Or you can have a relatively plain person transfigured by an inner glory and grandeur so that they strike you as beautiful. So there is a combination, and I'm not going to define which element contributes more, but both are involved. But an artist has the prerogative, when they create a character, of making exactly the kind of face to mirror the type of soul. They don't have to depend upon God or the genetic structure that was endowed by accident. They can make the essence of art is a purposeful recreation of reality. And so if in reality heroes happen to be born with all different ranges of DNA and some of them are hunchbacks, that is not a reason in fiction to have a hero with a hunchback. Not if you're writing romantic fiction, and that's what she was writing. She is not a naturalist. She did not purport to present, quote, things as they are. She said, read the newspaper if you want to see that. She is presenting man as he could be and should be. And from that point of view, she has the prerogative, the duty from the point of view of her philosophy, if she has the perfect soul, to embody it in a perfect body. And anything less than that would be a statement by her of the inferiority of his character. Because she would, it's the same issue, as, in case you ever heard of this, she had a discussion once about what would you think of a painting of a beautiful woman who had a cold sore on her lip? Now, cold sores happen in real life, but a cold sore in a painting would be a monstrous statement that beauty is a superficial veneer and that ugliness is man's essence. And by the exact same reasoning, if Ayn Rand's heroes were perfect psychologically and had long hooked nose or whatever deformity you want to give them, then she would have been telling us by the fact that she chose that as the expression, that these are imperfect beings. And that is the exact opposite of what her intention was. She wanted to glorify man, not roll him in the dirt. And that is the answer to your question and to the intention behind the question.
Okay. Sir.
Dr. Peikoff, yeah. From my point of view, advertising is really the sine qua non of picture mongering in many respects. I was wondering if you could comment.
Well, I don't think that advertising has to be that. I think a lot of advertising is an appeal to emotion. And I myself tune that stuff out. The instant that comes, I don't even notice it. It just doesn't register. It is possible to give rational, simplified arguments in favor of something, to pick out some one selling point that makes you stand above the competition and hammer that home, which would be a form of rationality. But if all you do is show bathing beauties in a context of automobiles or whatever it is, that is definitely picturism and that is irrational. Now, there's a lot of advertising people in objectivism, and I've had this argument with them several times. They say, we are not trying to prove in our advertising the virtues of our product. We're simply trying to get people to remember them. And therefore, when we have these stunning ladies, the whole purpose is not this car is therefore good, but the next time you go shopping for a car, you'll remember this lady, and therefore you'll remember the car, and you'll go to pick our car rather than some other. If that's the purpose, is simply a trigger to the memory, okay. I don't think that's very practical. I mean, I don't, if I'm going shopping for a car, I don't ransack my memory. Oh, yeah, I remember that one had the great, model, and therefore I'm going to do, I wouldn't even do that if I was buying toothpaste. So I don't think that that's very practical. More than that, I don't think most advertising would exist without the income tax anyway. Because of the case of Hershey's, it's been said frequently that if people could keep their money and there wasn't such an issue as deduction, most of the business expenditures that are now deducted wouldn't be spent. And it would be, I think advertising would be very, very, very much less of a factor. And when you engage in advertising in a rational world, you would want to pay for a point to get across. But we're talking about a better world than today.
Thank you. I'm going to use my prerogative and suggest that the three people standing are the last three people asking questions.
Then I'm we'll sorry, am I going on at too great a
No, 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 because it's just getting a little bit late.
Dr. Peikoff, I read somewhere that I believe it was in the Romantic Manifesto that Ayn Rand didn't consider a photograph as a piece of art and not an aesthetic one. So I was wondering what you thought movies, you know, successions of basically photographs, what kind of aesthetic role they played, and also as far as making a philosophical statement, you know, and I understand that Rand was working on a screenplay of Atlas Shrugged at the time of her death. And I was wondering if you could comment on what kind of philosophical statement you might be able to make through motion pictures.
You can make a philosophic statement through a motion picture if it's a philosophic motion picture which contains philosophic statements in it. And that's the kind that she wrote. And that's one of the reasons Hollywood does not want to make a movie out of it, because they can't find any way to film her novel without having some character say something philosophical. Now, movie makers are exactly like picturists. Their ideal is silent films. They regard dialogue as the enemy. And one movie maker, whose name you probably would have heard of, which I won't mention, told me that he regards dialogue as a confession of failure. That whenever he has to have a character say something that he can't simply show, he thinks that's a confession of impotence on his part, and he tries to avoid it. And his movies are correspondingly what you would expect. Now, of course, Ayn Rand didn't believe any such thing. So it's the same with a philosophic movie as with a philosophic book. What carries the point is the philosophic statements, not the photographs. Now, on your question of what is or isn't art is completely off the topic. But she would say a movie involves the kind of selectivity, the sequence, combining it with dialogue and music and so on, puts it in an entirely different category, and puts it in an artistic category in a way in which a simple still would not be. But that is a really different subject from where we are now.
Thank you. Sir?
First off, I like to call myself an objectivist, and I appreciate everything you said tonight. However, the vast majority of people think pragmatically, and given that fact, how could they interpret your remarks tonight when they're objectivists in nature, but they're interpreting it through their own pragmatic definitions?
Well, you mean to say that I can't speak to people?
No,
I'm not. Who aren't objectivists? I do it every day on the air. I have long conversations with devout Christians. I understand them and they understand me. What's the problem?
Well, I was just wondering if was there any way of cutting through the flotsam of just given the fact that there is so much information out there through the internet or television, I'm just trying to figure out how is it that you are successful in cutting through all the flotsam of the pragmatism that you have out there?
Well, most people are great mixtures of different ideas. If they haven't gone to college, they tend to be more sensible, more reasonable. And if they're older, they tend to be, just simply because they had a better education from another era. There are some people you can't cut through, you can't talk to at all. I would say, for instance, sight unseen, if somebody has a PhD in philosophy, they're untalkable to, they're ineffable. Because what they, I mean, excluding present company, but if what they had to go through in order to get their minds to the shape where a group of entrenched philosophers say, you are now a member of the club, is so awful that I don't know whether you can recover from that. But leaving aside people, you know, of that kind, most people have a more rational element, and the trick in talking to them is to get them to the more rational element. If you find that they won't do it, then you just end the conversation. But I find there's countless people that you can talk to. They don't have to know objectivism or be objectivists. I have no difficulty.
Thank you. Sir.
Concerning the abortion debate that you mentioned at the beginning, which spawned the lecture, which you declined, it seems to me it would have been a great opportunity to pit words against pictures and to present in that forum what you presented tonight.
And what that would mean, you mean I should have accepted the debate
and
given this speech?
It seems like you would have jumped at the chance, yeah.
You can't do it. You cannot go up against an emotionally impassioned audience with a dry intellectual argument. It simply can't be done because once your emotions are aroused and you're feeling outrage, you are not capable of objectivity. To be capable of objectivity is something that's volitional but requires conditions. For instance, you are capable, presumably, of weighing the pros and cons of something. But if you just see a horrible accident in the street and a girlfriend of yours has just been killed and you're absolutely grief-struck and overwhelmed and I come up to you and say, now I'd like you to consider objectively which of these two movies is better, you cannot do it even if you want to because you're so swamped by emotion. Your only rational response at that point is to say, when the emotion dies down tomorrow or next week, I will then think about it and I won't come to any conclusions until then. But you can't ever ask a person to say, here is an enraged audience, an audience that's been propagandized, had their emotions played on, and they're like a group of frenzied maniacs. Now go in and talk to them calmly and explain the importance of objectivity. You have no experience as a speaker if you think that can be done.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.